From HanselMinutes.com, it's Hansel Minutes, a weekly discussion with web developer and technologist Scott Hanselman. This is Lawrence Ryan announcing show number 245, recorded live Friday, December 17th, 2010. Support for Hansel Minutes is provided by Telerik RAD Controls, the most comprehensive suite of components for Windows Forms and ASP.NET web applications. Online at www.telerik.com. In this episode, Scott talks with John Batdorf about moving from small companies to large corporations.
Hi, this is Scott Hanselman, and this is another episode of Hansel Minutes. And today I'm sitting down with my good friend John Batdorf in his home. And John and I actually worked together in banking for years and years. Did I hook you up with the job?
Or yeah, you did. It was kind of a weird thing. I was leaving or working for a small agency, and you know, it was rough economic times. And they said to me one day, we're going to let you go in a month. And I kind of had already seen the writing on the wall. So I'd been talking to you about finding a more stable company. And the day that I got laid off, or essentially told I was being laid off, I got an offer from...
Which then got bought by... Yep. And when I was a... Gosh, I started out there, I want to say it was a couple of hundred people. By the time I left, it was 400 or 500.
Yeah, I think we peaked around 350 or 400 or so.
Yeah. What's it like to go from a company that's of a couple hundred people to a couple of tens of thousands of people?
Well, what's funny is I've always worked for small companies. And when people listening to this show hear small companies, they probably think a couple hundred people. But I mean like 20 people small. Like my day would be starting development and then... Oh my gosh, something would happen to the servers and the development would get put on a hold. And even though we had a system administrator, it was like the developers would get involved and maybe even the person that's like second in charge would be running in to put their 2 cents in and say, what's going on? But at a bigger company, even 300 people, which still pretty small, it's not like that. And then when you scale up to even bigger, it's less and less like that. You're further removed from those kind of things.
Is that because the bigger you get, the more people there are to have a specific job? Or, and you know, like in a small company, everyone owns everything. There's that notion, like an agile methodology of collective ownership. Like we all own the code, we all own the system. And in a small company, you know, you have access to the passwords on the production machine and you can run in there and save it just as much as the CTO can.
No, totally. That's like a hard transition to make too when you leave that kind of small entrepreneurial spirit. You know, you can really affect change. You know, about in a small company, you know, oh, we're pitching this client, and if our company gets this, it means new servers for everybody, or a new desktop machine, or better benefits, or something really tangible to you, so you're really vested to get it. But once you move to a bigger company, you don't really, it's like stuff just kind of comes down to mm-hmm. you. Oh, you know, you're going to be working on this project for the next 6 months. And you don't really, I mean, press releases are kind of like one of the ways I hear about things, as bad as that sounds. But, and you know, it's just the culture. It's just the way it is. It's not necessarily a negative thing. But yeah, you're not exposed to things the way you are in a smaller company.
Before I worked at Microsoft, I think I was like employee number 25. Small, what I like to call boutique consultancy. And what I liked about that company so much was that it was two guys owned the company and they were 50-50. And we would have company meetings and we'd go over the balance sheet. Like, I mean, think about that, right? We would have a company meeting and you could literally, everyone in the company could basically know the finances and you'd say, yeah, we just got the Acme website job and that's going to bring in $50,000 to the company. And like you just said, and we'll all be able to get new desks. And that was totally visible. So everything, not just from development through testing to production, but from the sales, you know, pipeline. Like any employee could log into the sales pipeline and see what was going on. And we could see that we really need to get this to hit the rent this month, et cetera, et cetera.
I worked at a place in Seattle that was probably, it was my first job out of college, and it was a little tiny, I think 30 person company called SiteWorks. They were bought up by a conglomerate probably about 3 or 4 years after I worked there or left. But, day one was, my first day was, all right, put your desk together and build your computer. And my desk was literally a door with four IKEA legs, and it was cool. And there was no cubicles, there was no walls, there was dogs running around the office. And one of the big things I remember was when we got a really huge, it was a Microsoft, I think Windows Media Player account or something, doing some of the corporate marketing for them, was that everybody got Aeron chairs, and that was like a huge deal. So the other really funny thing about that company was day one coming in fresh out of college. I mean, I'd done some web development in college for the university and for various offices at the university. They asked me, they sat me and this other guy down, who I'm actually still friends with, and they said to me, looked at me and said, which project would you like to work on? We have the Weyerhaeuser corporate website or U2's World Pop Mart Tour website.
Yeah, that's really a hard decision.
Yeah. So
when you describe the putting together of the desk, I was over talking to Alex Payne, who works on Bank Simple, and they're at an incubator downtown Portland. An incubator is basically a big warehouse where a bunch of companies all go together. So like if you and I were going to go and spin off our own company, we would call them up and we'd say, you know, get the hookup, pay $400 or $500 a month. They'd give us like a big wood door and two sawhorses.
That's hilarious.
And that would be your desk. And I think that they do that not just because they're trying to be inexpensive, but there's just something about the legend of a startup and the two sawhorses and the big door for a desk that gets people like, let's keep it fast and lean and focused. You know what I mean?
It's cool. And it's funny because I wouldn't have imagined that would be the first thing I was doing at my first job. Mm-hmm. But looking back over the years, that's probably one of the favorite places that I've worked at over the, you know, last 10, 15 years.
I think I was still at Step. Around 2010. I want to say 95, 96. We were working on this website called 800.com.
I remember that.
You remember 800.com?
Oh, yeah.
800.com. It was like pre-Amazon.com. They did this deal once about three DVDs for a dollar. And we didn't actually have space, so we were borrowing space from someone else. And there was a time where some of us were literally sitting on the stairs because there were no desks. So we had like, you know, walk to the left because everyone's on the right side of the staircase. This like big spiral staircase, and we're all just kind of sitting there.
Wow.
And using conference rooms as war rooms just because that's the only space that you can have. One of the things that I've noticed about little company to big company transitions is whether or not you have control of your own computer.
Oh, yeah. That's constantly a point of contention.
Is it? That's a very politically correct way of putting that.
So at the company I work at now, I mean, the majority of the company is still on XP. So, there's lots of people that would prefer to be on a newer operating system mm-hmm. and have newer software. But sometimes that's kind of one of the things that you trade off working for a big company is that the IT people who are completely awesome and the two IT guys we have are probably the best IT guys I've worked with. Mm-hmm. And it's not necessarily their decision, but as a company, you know, this is our direction. This is where we're staying. And
right.
Obviously I think they're making strides to move forward with that, but that kind of change doesn't happen overnight. Whereas a small company, it's like, you could say, hey, the beta for Windows 7 is out. Can I put it on my machine? And the response would be, yeah, but your response, if it doesn't work out, you got to put whatever else was back on there. And if you're up till 3 a.m. doing it, that's right. Kind of your deal.
Yeah, I recognize that controls have to be put in place for, you know, corporate governance and laws and federal this and that. But I remember that one of the most uncomfortable transitions between the small boutique consultancy and what was then called was that I couldn't add a machine to the domain. without filling out a form. So like if I brought a machine in, I would have to go and ask permission. And I'd have to get the IT guy to walk over to my desk as I'm, you know, installing Windows and type in his password so he could add machines to the domain. And, but it seems though that there's a, there's kind of this, this hump. If you imagine on the far left of a graph, you've got 20 people in a room and you can point across the room and see the domain controller. You go like, yeah, that's the server right there. And then you, as you get bigger and bigger, you can say, well, that closet is where the servers are, right? And you get bigger and bigger. And then you say, well, that room is where the servers are.
And at some point, you're like, I have no idea where the server is.
Well,
or what it's even called.
But see, what's interesting is that you actually know your IT guys. Like, you've seen them.
Yeah.
I've worked at Microsoft 3 years, and I have never seen an IT guy. Like, I know that they're there. I've never seen one in person. But I have the ability to add a machine to the domain. So it's like there's this hump that you get over where it's like at a certain size, maybe 500 people, it's the most restrictive. Like they're super, super paranoid and they've grown up in the only way that they know how. And the only thing that they know how to do is increase control by clamping down and allowing you to do effectively nothing.
So Microsoft figures that their network infrastructure is set up so well and there's not much damage you can do.
Well,
adding a PC to the domain.
It, what they've done is because they're so big, they have scaled the automation. It's so incredibly automated that they'll prevent you from hurting yourself. So, for example, if I add a machine to the domain, right away that machine is controlled by the group policy.
Right.
So, you know, it has to, it won't be allowed on the internet without, or even on the intranet without all of these appropriate firewalls and antivirus so tools and things that get pushed down automatically. You have constant kind of security checks and compliance. It's so automated. It's actually automated so well that it doesn't hurt so bad. Like it might sound difficult, but I got an email, actually a couple of days ago that there's a patch for some Adobe Flash thing that I didn't know I didn't have on one of my machines I'd forgotten about. So it's like a very, very clean, formal email. You are the owner of this machine. And we have detected that you do not have this patch. You have 2 days to install this patch or we'll take you off the network.
Oh, wow.
So it's the kind of email that you would probably get from one of your two guys, except it's automated. Huh. So I think what happens is after 400 or 500 people, when things are at their most restrictive, somebody says, we need to automate this.
Right.
To and then the, things become slightly less restrictive.
To alleviate all the work they have to do to make those kind of things happen.
Yeah, exactly. So being able to add a machine, you know, someone decided, I presume, at Microsoft that being able to add a machine to the network is important, but they tied it to you as an employee such that they know what I have. Like they have like this automatic asset system. They know what phones I have, what computers I have. And as they move around, they can kind of shut you off the network and they can say, well, that's Hanselman's remote cart, his remote video cart, and he doesn't have this patch and we've warned him 3 times. So he's out.
But you're not out forever. It's you patch it and
then you're back on.
You go back in.
And actually, they're so fine grained. I remember. Do you remember the Code Red virus? The whole So years and years ago, I was actually as a vendor inside. I was on campus at Microsoft,
razzing into their network.
No, we were actually local. I was physically there, and I was there actually. I think it was Yuval Lowry, who is a he's an MVP and a really well known speaker and stuff. And Yuval, we were in there for like SQL Server, some kind of a design review. I don't remember what it was. But what I remember distinctly was that suddenly we're sitting in this conference room, we're having our meeting, and the network goes out. And I'm like, okay, I can't get on the web. I have no email. This is like 6-7 years ago, whenever Code Red happened, or NIMDA.
Right.
And then two guys walk in the room, and they say, someone in here has a virus, and we've shut access to this room.
Wow.
Off. So we did. I thought that it went out at the entire building or whatever, or the entire internet went down, right? Because that's what it feels like. But they had a granularity where they detected, you know, evil.
Don't you want to imagine there was like this 3D model that spun around and the room lit up and flashed red and
yes,
there was like this voice that was like dispatched, you know, security team alpha to sector 4.
It's exactly. Probably just not, like but... like that that Jurassic Park thing where the girl's like, this is a Unix machine. I know how to use this.
I know this.
Yeah. Two guys walked in. They shut the room off. So they actually knew at the port level.
Wow.
And that was actually the only time I'd ever seen anyone. Actually, I was just thinking about that. I had said before, I'd never seen an IT guy. that was one time, and I haven't seen one since. They've always been kind of nameless, faceless aliases that I talk to. I'm trying to get access for my video conferencing system, and I've been having all these interactions with all these different people talking about a port, a specific port that I need enabled on a specific physical port on the wall. And there's a security review and da 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 da. And even though it's
the presence,
the telepresence thing.
Telepresence thing that you built.
Damian Edwards and I need to get access to a specific TCP port. So I fill out a form. It's all automated. It goes to an automated system, and then a human gets involved. They did a security analysis, and it's not just for one machine to get access to one port, but literally a port in the wall in my office in Building 42 is going to have access to this particular port. And, it's all very, very automated, and apparently it's tied to my my employment contract, such that if I abuse my privileges having access to this port outside the firewall, then they can fire me.
Wow.
Yeah. I wonder how that would happen. Like, if you're doing if you're in a small company, I mean, I just remembered saying, hey, I want that port open to the internet, right?
Yeah, nobody would even really ask why, right? They would just be like, oh yeah, I can do that.
Yeah. But the interesting thing is that that's when companies get nailed, right? It's right at that point where they're starting to grow.
Right. That first company in Seattle, when we got our T1, that was a big deal.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember a couple times of somebody going, oh no, I think we have a virus. And the solution was run to the server room and unplug the internet.
Yeah, exactly.
I mean, Wild West, right? We didn't have firewalls. We didn't have.
Hi, this is Scott coming to you from another place in time. Are you using agile practices to manage your software development? There's lots of tools in the market that manage the steps of a project, but most of them focus on individual roles. Get ready for a solution that caters for the success of the whole team. The guys at Telerik introduced TeamPulse. It's an agile project management tool that'll help you gather ideas, estimate, plan, track progress in a common workspace. Finally, companies, regardless of their size, can use a lightweight and convenient tool that makes all the stakeholders work as a united team, even if they're in different countries. By combining intuitive user interface and the power of Silverlight, TeamPulse removes the roadblocks that you typically face in applying Agile in an effective manner. No more lost data, no disparate systems, no lack of critical analytics regarding the health and velocity of your project. See for yourself. Get a free copy for 5 users and 1 project at Telerik.com/TeamPulse. And please do thank Telerik for supporting Hansel Minutes on their Facebook fan page, facebook.com/TELERIK, Telerik. We do appreciate it. There wouldn't be a Hansel Minutes if there wasn't Telerik helping us. Well, how do you solve that problem? Like, did you get an email from Gawker Media this week?
Yes. No, actually, I didn't get an email, but I did. LinkedIn was kind enough to say, you might have used the same password on LinkedIn that you had for comments, and it got me to change my LinkedIn password.
Right.
And I couldn't remember if I'd ever signed up for, I mean, I read Lifehacker, I read Gizmodo, I read Engadget, I read all those, mm-hmm. but I don't know if I've ever made a comment.
Exactly. I didn't even know I had an account there. So for those of you who are listening who may not be familiar with this, a hacker group hit a conglomerate, a company called Gawker, G-A-W-K-E-R, Gawker Media, who is the owner of a bunch of blogs like Lifehacker and Gizmodo. So they're kind of a holding company for blogs. But they're not very big. Like, they're big in the sense of there's a lot of popular blogs that with names you'd recognize. But they're not big in the sense that they obviously don't have a very large IT department. They're probably a pretty small company. You know, I guess maybe a couple hundred people, if not less.
Yeah, probably.
So they got nailed this week by a hacker group that literally stole a copy of their database. And actually, Coding Horror, Jeff Atwood had a very good blog post about all the things that were wrong with this. But ultimately, they posted all of our email addresses and passwords. So they were literally storing our passwords in clear text in their database. So you got an email from LinkedIn. I got an email from Hulu, from Netflix, saying we have detected that, you know, you used your email address and da-da-da-da-da. So I went and changed my passwords everywhere.
Yeah, now I'm thinking I should probably go change Netflix.
Well, so that here's the bad part, though. I don't know what password I used at Gawker.
I don't know either.
So I don't know if I should change my passwords at 25 places. It certainly shows a big problem with a number of things. Identity on the web is broken. Everyone uses the same password. I guess, like, the word monkey was in the top 10 passwords used.
Yeah, I think 123456 was one of the top ones.
Yeah, password with an at sign for the A, I don't know why Monkey was in the top 10, but
So what about something like, I mean, not to stray off topic here, but what about something like LastPass? What are your feelings on like
that? I totally use LastPass.
I do too, but I don't use it the way that they probably want me to use it. Like, they probably want me to generate some password that I don't even know what it is, right?
Because but then when you're out and about somewhere with your iPhone, you're not going to be able to get on.
Right. Or you have to log into LastPass. You have to go to the page and say, show me the password, and copy and paste it. It's a total
There's
pain.
No password management solution that's reasonable.
No, I agree.
But the point I wanted to make was that here's a company, let's just call them a small company because I don't know how big they are, that is successful. Clearly, because we all read these websites, but they made a mistake at an IT level. Was it okay for them to have made that mistake when they were five people or two guys in a garage? At what point do you start to tighten the screws and be serious about the business? What if this happened to a one person company?
Well, the thing is, right, is it's almost like you should have known better, right?
Well, the hindsight is always 20/20. They should have known better.
I mean, passwords in the clear. I mean, I do small projects for nonprofit agencies and stuff, and I'll never do that. I'll always encrypt stuff or hash it or something.
Well, that's the obvious thing, but there could have been, you know, let's say that you do all those things, but you could still get nailed somehow, right? You know.
Oh, sure, you still could, but the
auditing and the fact that they have had security reviews, like at what size should a company start to turn the screws and make their IT practices best practices?
It probably takes something like this to make it happen. I mean, as sad as that sounds, but I mean, we've all been in the room when we're trying to explain to a manager or something that, look, this is just the right way to do this, and they say, well, how much time is that going to mm-hmm. take? And you say 40 hours, and they say, well, we can't charge the client for that, or we can't you know, bill this company for this work, and you know, that's, we're too small to do. I mean, I don't know. I don't know if there's like a 100 is the number, or
yeah, exactly
500. But literally, it always takes something like this for someone to go, oh, shoot, yeah, somebody warned me about this, didn't they?
We had an. I'm trying to remember who we had on the show recently, a couple of weeks ago, was talking about standards. It was Steve Sanderson. He was talking about Knockout.js. Knockout.js is a JavaScript library that lets you put HTML5 attributes on HTML elements and use JavaScript to data bind. And he made the comment that it'll work on IE6. But we know that HTML5 doesn't work on IE6. And he says, well, you know, it won't validate. But he said, I've never had an IT person tell me that, you know, I care more about validation, you know, valid HTML than about the business problem. Yeah. You know, and you bring up an interesting point that, you know, you go and you talk to the boss, you know, the suit, whoever they are, and you explain the situation and you say, here's the risk. We're going to do X and it'll cost this much. We're going to do Y. It'll cost that much more. Y is more secure. Which do you want? And they're going to make a decision. It may not always be the right one.
And in a bigger company, they are a lot more likely to listen to those kind of things. So smaller company, 20, 30 people, you say 40 hours, they instantly think, wow, I'm charging $200 an hour for you. 40 hours, that's a ton of lost revenue mm-hmm. for something that might not even happen. Whereas in a bigger company, you might say that's 125 hours and nobody even blinks. They're like, yeah, that's the right way. That's what you should do. Mm-hmm. I'm sure that obviously that probably doesn't happen sometimes as well, even in bigger companies, but especially around the software markets that, you know, you and I were working in, security is probably one of the biggest concerns.
I will say that definitely. When I was working at it was only a couple of hundred people. We had Greg Hughes, who was the host of Run As Radio, as one of the main security guys. Definitely not screwing around. Like when you're working with the Fed and working with all the regulators that are crawling around. I told a story once about how I received some customer data, like in an email.
And they wipe your machine?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So you know, right? I mean, yeah. I just literally, I kind of joke about it, but it was effectively, I stood up, I put my hands up in the air. I didn't touch my machine and I like called for help. And they came and they like, you know, they did the whole, you know.
And there's that moment of, oh no, why did you send me this?
Yes. Exactly. But the process was in place.
Yep.
And they nuked the machine and they nuked every machine that machine ever looked at. You know, they did the complete chain of custody.
Yep.
And it was like a bummer, but it was good that we had that in place.
Yeah, because then it takes away all reason of doubt from you. I mean, there's nobody can ever say that, oh, that might have been on his machine or.
Right. Well, it brings up an interesting question, though, when we do work on the site, you know, like you've mentioned that you did a little nonprofit business here and there, and I've done a little work on the side with, you know, small consulting gigs and stuff. But we're starting as small businesses, as one and two person, you know, side shops to use cloud services. Like you use, some invoicing software, right? Like I've used simplybill.com and
the stuff that I've used has just been Google Docs. I mean, Google it's Docs. Pretty simple, but.
Well, but see, are you storing credit cards? You know, that's kind of the question. Like when you bring it, but you know what I'm saying? When you think about a small company, a one person or a 10 person company who uses all these different cloud services, there might be someone who has. Let me rephrase it this way. You're a small consultancy that before you worked in your current job, you had 20 people, you said?
Right.
But that was years ago.
Right.
Right? If that exact same company of that exact same size was starting up now, some large number, half or more, possibly all of the services that it used would be in the cloud.
Oh, yeah. Totally.
How do you know then if those services are not themselves small businesses with bad practices? Storing credit cards and passwords.
Well, you don't. And then even with, you say, oh, well, it's Google, but you know, Google's not impervious to any of this either, right?
Sure.
I mean, you really want to assume and think that, oh, well, Google knows what they're doing. Maybe they've just gotten really lucky so far or maybe they do know what they're doing.
But chances are Google won't goof it up as much as, you know, Fred's personal invoicing system.com.
Right.
But it brings up an interesting point because now you're distributing the risk amongst a bunch of other folks also small businesses. It makes me wonder what's next in the sense of is someone, you know, if like PayPal or QuickBooks or some small system that is used by thousands, where does that risk get distributed? Like if someone gets sued, someone gets nailed, like what do you do? Do you go to your client and say, hey, my small client, the upstream cloud-based invoicing provider that I use was storing credit cards.
I if that was something that happened to me, I think I would have to obviously be honest and go forward to them and say, this event has happened. Here's what I know. Here's what they did. I mean, how can I make you feel better?
But is there some way to mitigate that, right? Why not? Ask them for a copy of their security policy or their privacy policy.
I'm sure all that stuff is in the terms and conditions that we all gloss over. We just, accept.
Exactly. And what you just said, I think, is the point that we all gloss over. I think that the fact that we distribute those things now as small businesses and smaller companies means that we shouldn't gloss over them. Like you and I and people who are listening who are doing micro ISVs should audit those services that they use and just take, it's kind of like, you know, once a year you change the batteries on your smoke detectors and you turn your clocks back. Maybe you should go and audit the services that your company uses and just take a day, get those policies and make sure that they're in line with what you want to provide to your customers.
Even then it's not a guarantee though, right?
But don't you think that the doing it is better than the not doing it?
It
like you're basically, I'm looking at you. You have kind of like a.
I just don't know that I'm even qualified to do that. I don't. I mean, other than read some legalese or something and try to interpret what somebody says they're going to do or how they say they operate.
Yeah, but that there is true that what they write down may not be necessarily what they're doing. But I think that the consciousness of it is the point. The being conscious and saying, "Here's my workflow." Client comes in, I put his, or qualified lead comes in, I put that into this application in the cloud, salesforce.com or whatever.
Sure.
Client becomes a qualified lead, and then I start to sell to the client, I start to invoice them with whatever, simplybill.com or Fred's invoicing. And then those payments come in via PayPal, da da da. So, you know, client personal information is moving from machine to machine, cloud system to cloud system. Let me give you another example. I was at my chiropractor this afternoon, and I was noticing as we were sitting in his office that he had Excel documents sitting on his desktop. You know, I wasn't looking at them, but I saw the Excel icon, and it crossed my mind, I wonder if my social security number is sitting on this guy's machine that he bought at Office Depot.
It probably is.
And what is my right, or what should I do as a consumer with this small business, who is a growing business, right? If it was a chain, a chiropractic chain, they would have an IT department that would have locked all this stuff down.
Right.
But at what point does that happen, right? How many people do we interact with on a regular basis have, you know, our personal information sitting in their email or on their desktop? And to our original point at the beginning of this whole show, how big is the point where that starts to really matter?
Again, I think it as bad as it sounds, I think it takes something has to happen to make somebody wake up and smell the coffee.
That bothers me. That like you're basically saying until something goes wrong, no one's going to say anything.
I mean, people didn't probably install smoke alarms until houses started burning down, right? I mean,
yeah, that's true. This brings up actually the backup issue that I had last week. You remember my hard drive crashed?
Yeah, your SSD.
Yeah, and I mentioned on Twitter that you know, backups always work. It's restores that fail. I actually had a comment on my blog today where someone questioned that I was lying about the restore because they had never really had a restore succeed. They'd had all these backups, but you know, restoring just never quite works out for them.
Well, how many times I've heard it I've heard it more than 10 times of, oh yeah, we have a backup policy. And I've actually heard people say, have you ever tried to do a restore? And there's that awkward pause and people say, what do you mean?
Mm-hmm.
So I've worked at two companies I can think of that I, you know, I'd ask the question, is this all this backed up? And people would say yes. And then some catastrophic event would happen. And before you know it, people are like, look in your temporary internet files. You know, they're grasping it. How do we get this data back? How do we, you know, something's lost.
I was talking to some guys at Microsoft that run a large website. And many, many years ago, this website went down. And basically, it went down because the SQL Server failed. And they had dropped someone was poking around. There weren't things in place. And someone dropped a table. And, you know, horrific things happened, and a week later the site came back up and all the processors were put in place. And when they were talking to the forensics guy afterwards, and they said, well, what should we have done? Because the forensics guy was poking around on the hard drive trying to figure out how he could get this table back. And he said, if you delete something that is so crucial, so important that it can't be deleted, if you find yourself in that situation, he said, pull the power cord. Don't let that hard drive write another byte.
Oh, wow.
Because then you want to mount that hard drive read-only and poke around it for it. Turned out that after this bad thing happened, the person who did it ended up trying to do a bunch of other stuff. And it was in the stumbling around that they basically erased their evidence. It's kind of like, you know, I've dropped something in a pile of powdered sugar on the ground, so I'm going to stomp around on it trying to find my lost contact lens.
Totally.
Everything goes bad. And they destroyed all the evidence and pounded on the disk.
Ouch.
Got to put those processes in place. Yeah, I think that if a small company should think about this kind of stuff now before they become big companies.
Yeah, and I think small companies need to realize that there's just a certain cost to do business, and just being acting in a responsible way, and it's not all about what our books look like, right? It's about, are we doing the right thing for our clients? Are we doing the right thing for our employees? There's just costs involved with doing business. I mean, sometimes it's a new monitor. Sometimes it's time. Sometimes it's something else. But
yeah, sometimes it's auditing your security system and reading legalese just to make sure that you've done it at least once.
And that's kind of where small companies get so focused on the bottom line. And sometimes it's because you don't even know it, but they're barely making payroll every month.
Yeah. Well, thanks, John Batdor, for talking to me about that transition between small, medium, and large companies. I know I've made that transition, and you've made that transition, and it's definitely an interesting ride. I wonder what my next company will be someday in the future, whether it'll be bigger or smaller than Microsoft.
I appreciate your time. Thanks, Scott.
This has been another episode of Hansel Minutes, and I'll see you again next week.